I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, we'll spend the hour with Congressman John Sarbanes. Sarbanes was just elected to a seventh term representing Maryland's 3rd congressional district. He serves on the House Oversight Committee, and he chairs the Democracy Reform Task Force. He has emerged as a key figure in fashioning a package of legislation that addresses ethics and campaign finance reform, as well as voting rights. How will Democrats choose to scrutinize President Trump's finances? And how will they pursue charges of ethics and campaign finance violations by the Trump administration? How will Congress react to the recent ruling by a Texas judge striking down Obamacare? And what are the prospects of a partial government shutdown on Friday, which could affect as many as 300,000 Marylanders who are part of the federal workforce? Congressman John Sarbanes joins me when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Congressman John Sarbanes joins us for the hour today. Last month, he was reelected to represent Maryland's 3rd congressional district for a 7th term. His district includes parts of Baltimore City, as well as Baltimore, Howard, Anne Arundel, and Montgomery counties. Representative Sarbanes serves on the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, which in the new Congress will be chaired by his colleague in the Maryland congressional delegation, Elijah Cummings. And for nearly 2 years, Mr. Sarbanes has chaired the House Democracy Reform Task Force, a group of legislators who are focused on minimizing the influence of special interests and ensuring fair elections. Sarbanes is the primary author of a bill that addresses ethics and campaign finance reform, as well as voting rights protections. Representative Nancy Pelosi, who will likely be the new Speaker of the House, has designated this bill as H.R. 1. It will be the first order of business that the House takes up when the new Congress begins on the 3rd of January. We will take your calls and comments a little later in the show. In the meantime, we are streaming our conversation on the WIPR Facebook page. Congressman, good to see you, sir.
Great to be here, Tom, as always.
So tell us what's in H.R. 1, the bill that you're the primary author of.
Well, there's a lot in there, and we're very excited, as you said, to be moving this as the first order of business in the 116th Congress. Let me just explain why we think it makes sense to come out of the gate with that strong statement on reform. If you talk to voters, if you look at the message that was most resonant in this 2018 midterm, among the top two or three issues, you see democracy reform, this idea that Washington is much too influenced by special interests, that there's too much corruption there, and that we have to clean up the system. And that message came through loud and clear from the electorate in the 2018 midterms. It's something that we want to move on quickly to show that we heard people, that we want to give them their voice back, that we respect this yearning, really, to clean up the system and make it work for everyday Americans. So that's why it's the first order of business. As you look at the kinds of reforms people are interested in, they assemble themselves organically into three broad categories. One is, let's make it easier, not harder, to vote in America. You look across the country, it's incredible that every 2 years we seem to have these same kinds of issues come up again and again. Here we are 240 years into our republic, more than 50 years after John Lewis was almost beaten to death walking across the Edmund Pettus Bridge demonstrating for voting rights, and we still can't seem to get it right in terms of voting. So there's a whole series of measures that can improve people's opportunity to register, to vote, so things like automatic voter registration, same-day registration, early voting, no-excuse absentee ballot voting across the country, and other measures that just make it possible for people to vote without having to go through an obstacle course. So that's about respecting the voter. In that same category, by the way, and we've talked about this before, redistricting reform, because people want to see maps drawn in a fair way. So that's also included in the voting section. So that's
Before we go into the other two sections, I know there is a lot in this bill, but when it comes to those two things, what's the role of the federal government as opposed to the state government?
Here in Maryland,
for example, we just passed by referendum a measure that allows for same-day registration on the day that you vote in the next general election, that kind of thing. Redistricting, there's a court order now to redistrict at least one of the districts here in Maryland. I mean, and so much of voting is controlled by the states. Are you going to try to reinstate the provisions in the Voting Rights Act that were gotten rid of by the Supreme Court decision in 2013?
Right. So all good questions. In terms of the control or authority that the federal government has with respect to voting that happens in the states, we have pretty good authority under something called the time, place, and manner provision of the Constitution on how federal elections are conducted. So we can insist on certain things there. With respect to how state elections operate, and a lot of the systems are sort of built up through the states, what we can do is incentivize those states to meet certain uniform best practices by offering resources. The Help America Vote Act of 2002, which was passed in response to what happened in Florida during the 2000 election, provides resources that you can say to states, if you want to access these dollars to help strengthen your election systems, you got to meet certain standards. So we can offer those resources as a way of getting states to step up to the plate. In terms of the Voting Rights Act, that's an excellent question. As you know, the Shelby case, the Supreme Court case, struck a very important provision in the Voting Rights Act called the preclearance provision, which required that certain states where there was a historic situation of discrimination in terms of how voting operated had to get new measures pre-cleared by the Justice Department. That was struck, and the Supreme Court said to the Congress, go back and come up with a new formula. We haven't done that yet. We need to do it. So we are going to have a special handling of that particular issue on the voting front, because the court has said they want an extensive record built to justify any new formula. So the Voting Rights Act piece will be pulled out, given special handling, but it's part of the overall reform approach that we see in this voting basket. So anyway, voting is key.
So a vote for this bill then votes for the authorization to take a closer look at that provision.
It'll be an affirmation of let's go forward, create that special set of hearings, including, frankly, field hearings across the country to hear testimony about what happened in this last election that reflects, again, this kind of historic discrimination that has occurred when it comes to voting rights in certain parts of the country. So that's a key piece. The second basket we want to focus on is this idea, very simply, that when people go to Washington to serve in the executive branch or the legislative branch, they ought to behave themselves. There's certain codes of ethics, guidelines, that ought to apply. And so in that basket, you have more transparency and accountability measures. You have strengthening of the Office of Government Ethics, which is the cop on the beat in terms of how the executive branch operates, certain requirements with respect to lobbyists, where they have to kind of register and raise their hand in a new and more compelling way.
Does it strengthen enforcement, or are there new ethical guidelines?
There'll be new enforcement authority for the Office of Government Ethics. But for example, under the Obama administration, there were some very clear conflict of interest rules and policies that were put in place for the way the executive branch and the White House operated. This administration has completely upended those guidelines. They used to be just sort of norms that would be put in place. We think they now need to be codified and put into statute. So those conflict of interest guidelines are applicable whoever might be president. So that's an example. Requiring that if you run for president, you have to disclose your tax returns. Again, this is something people always did in the past. This president chose not to. 80% of the American public thinks that that is a reasonable requirement. So we're going to put that in place. So these are all the things that have to do with ethics, integrity, accountability in government. the public has a real appetite to see that kind of change. And then the last piece, the last basket of reforms, has to do with campaign finance. Cleaning up the campaign finance system to remove the undue influence that special interests have, that super PACs have, that millionaires and billionaires have when it comes to how policy is made and how elections and the outcomes of elections are being influenced. So transparency and disclosure, where's the money coming from? Building up a new system of funding campaigns for the 21st century that's based on small donors and matching funds, which is really kind of a power move on the part of a disaffected electorate out there saying, you know, we want to be in charge here, so we're going to take over. Measures of that kind, which really show that we're going to be responsive and accountable, not to the special interests, not to the big money, not to the insiders, but to everyday Americans who deserve to have us serve them and them alone.
It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest today, Congressman John Sarbanes. We are streaming our conversation on the WIPR Facebook page, and you can start sending in some calls and emails in the latter parts of the program. So, Congressman, why now? And I don't ask that naively. I mean, obviously, the Democrats picked up 40 seats and now control Congress. But when it comes to things like campaign finance reform and shifting the focus to small donor donations, this is something you've been working on for years.
Sure.
Senator McConnell has voiced no interest whatsoever in taking up this kind of legislation in the Senate. It seems likely that these reforms, as you say, which do in many instances enjoy broad public support, will also get support of the democratically controlled Congress. So then what happens to the bill? I mean, is this a showpiece? Is this a statement? Or is this a true effort to actually get legislation enacted?
I think it serves many purposes. First of all, I agree with you 100%. Mitch McConnell will not let this thing see the light of day in the Senate. In fact, all the reforms that we want to put in place are things he's been working against his whole career. If he were to take H.R. 1 and remove the pieces he doesn't like, it would be maybe a paragraph at the end. But here's what we accomplish. Number one, we say back to an electorate that clearly indicated in this midterm that they want to see these democracy reforms and they want to clean up corruption. We heard you. We heard you. Your message came through loud and clear, and we're going to do everything we can where we have the gavel, which is in the House of Representatives, to respond and respond quickly. So that's a matter of respecting the people who sent you there and the message that they gave you. Number two, if we come out of the first days of the new Congress having passed this powerful reform package, it begins to put pressure on the Republicans to get with the program, because I think they're going to see that it's very positively received by the electorate, not just Democrats, but independents and Republicans. Independents, by the way, in the last election, in the last 6 weeks, in free response surveys, they were picking corruption as the number one issue that had to be addressed. Above healthcare, above jobs, they picked corruption. So this has broad appeal, and I think Republicans who are in touch with their own districts will see that, and maybe we can begin to get some cooperation from certain Republican members of Congress. So it has value there. Third, what it's saying to the public is, when you give Democrats the gavel, this is the change you can expect. So if you like this change, then give us a gavel in the Senate, give us a pen in the White House, and we'll go fix the democracy. We won't tear it down like Donald Trump is trying to do. He brought in a demolition crew. We want to bring in a hazmat team. We want to clean this up and make it work for the public. And then the last thing I would say is, on the day you pass this, you make a statement about the kind of standards you want to be judged by in Washington that begins in that moment to change the culture. Donald Trump, by his behavior and by his ethical blindness, I think, has changed the culture in a negative way. We want to step up and say there's a new set of standards that we think should apply to lawmakers in Washington. These are standards we commit to. And in the moment you make that declaration, you actually begin to change culture in a positive way. And I think the public wants to see that.
Congressman John Sarbanes is my guest for the hour. He has represented Maryland's 3rd congressional district since 2007. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will open up the phones and take your emails and tweets. 410-662-8780. Our email midday at WYPR.org. To send us a tweet, it's at midday WYPR. And we are, as I mentioned, streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on our program tomorrow, it's midday with the mayor. Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh joins me right here in Studio A. We'll have an update from City Hall. We'll talk about the status of the nomination of Joel Fitzgerald to lead the Baltimore Police Department and a whole bunch of other issues. So hope you can join us tomorrow here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, Congressman John Sarbanes is my guest. He represents Maryland's 3rd congressional district, which includes parts of Baltimore City as well as Baltimore, Howard, Anne Arundel, and Montgomery counties. And he chairs the Democracy Reform Task Force in the House. You are welcome to be part of our conversation here with Congressman Sarbanes. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday at WYPR.org. Our Twitter handle, at midday WYPR. To follow me on Twitter, at Tom Hall WYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Let me talk a little bit more about voting and district redistricting and gerrymandering. Part of the effort that you're involved in is to, on the congressional level, to foster the use of nonpartisan commissions to draw right. new congressional districts. This is something that Governor Hogan has done. He's appointed a commission. And Brian Frosch, the Maryland Attorney General, he's a Democrat. Mr. Hogan's a Republican, has opposed that. So they're not working off the same page by any means. But as well, the Democratic leadership in the Maryland House and Senate also opposes any redistricting that doesn't involve other states as well. They don't want to unilaterally change how Maryland is redistricted without Virginia, Pennsylvania, et cetera. And Governor Hogan has said that's a non-starter for him. You are in one of the most, you know, bizarrely concocted districts in all of Congress. I mean, people often point to the 3rd district because it spans so many different counties and it goes to so many different little tributaries along the map. Are commissions the way to go? Is that a good idea for Maryland? And should Maryland move individually without the cooperation of some of the contiguous states?
I think whatever solution you come up with in terms of the drawing of maps in a fair way, it's got to be something that's done across the country. If you do it in certain states and not others, the result will be that you'll, frankly, probably intensify the politics of it in the places where it remains done kind of the old way. So from the beginning, my view has been, and we have over 80 co-sponsors now in Congress of a bill that would do this nationally, you have to create these independent commissions in every state.
So we does H.R. 1 do that? Does this
yes,
bill that
it includes, mm-hmm. well, what H.R. 1 is going to do is prescribe some remedy for this where you can get fair maps drawn. It will either be to specifically call for a certain kind of remedy, like independent commissions, or it could be requiring that a certain set of standards be met that mean that the maps will be drawn in a fair way. But I was talking to former Attorney General Holder the other day, and he's led an effort over the last couple of years to really look at this issue of redistricting and how it's done across the country. And he said every forum that they held, the number one theme from the audience was fairness. It's got to be fair. People have to feel respected by the process. So however you do it, you want to be able to give the public confidence that the map that gets drawn is a fair map. And I think you got to give them that confidence across the country, because otherwise you're going to continue to have this situation where often the officials that get elected in terms of the numbers and composition, not just in Congress, but in state legislatures, doesn't accurately reflect what the voters intend. That's the disconnect that I think frustrates a lot of people, and there's ways to address it. So we absolutely are planning to include within the four corners of the H.R. 1 reform package measures that will lead to drawing fairer maps for people everywhere in the country.
Democrats drew 8.9 million more votes than Republicans did in the 2018 midterm elections.
Right.
Of the 50 governorships that were controlled, state houses that were controlled by Republicans, it's gone from 17 to 4, 332 seats in state legislators. So there was a strong message sent by Democratic voters or voters who are voting for the as part of this blue wave. However, in 2016, Donald Trump, at least by the Electoral College, was elected to blow things up. He was elected to turn things around. He was elected to upend the system. His voters, of which, you know, they are perhaps a minority, but they are very intensely still in his corner to this day, voted for this disruption. Right. How does that fit into it? And so there's one message coming out of 2018, but just 2 years prior, there was another message. But right. Are those messages at all congruent? I mean, is there
I think they are.
Consistency?
I think that what people voted for in 16 was not for to sort of tear government down, but to clean government up. Trump used the phrase drain the swamp. Now, drain the swamp means that you go clean it up. You make things work again. But the line between being disruptive and being destructive is a thin line. And I think what's happened is a lot of people that thought that he was going to come and fight on their behalf by being disruptive are now beginning to step back a little bit and reevaluate. Not all of them, clearly. But there's a group of people that thought that he was going to fight for them and maybe be disruptive in doing so, who now see things that are more destructive and not necessarily benefiting them. And I think this election showed some people beginning to step back, reevaluate, and so that's why you had Democrats winning in a number of districts across the country in this last election that Donald Trump won 2 years before. What's consistent in terms of what the electorate is saying is, we don't feel included in Washington. We feel like insiders run the show, and we want more respect. But they haven't abandoned the idea that government can work for them, that can be an instrument of their will, that can improve the quality of their lives. They just lack confidence in the people that are running it, doing it on their behalf instead of serving the special interest. That's why I keep saying we want to clean it up. We want to bring the hazmat team in and make government work again. We don't want to tear it down and destroy it, because if you do that, it can't serve anybody's interest. The public wants government to work for them. We think we can clean it up with the kind of program and proposal that we're bringing with this H.R. 1 democracy reform package. We want to do that early and send that positive message to the electorate. And if they like that, they'll continue to demand it. And hopefully in their voting will reflect that.
Congressman John Sarbanes is my guest for the hour. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wipr.org. You can also drop us a tweet and follow us on Facebook. Let's go to Stan in Towson. Stan, welcome to Midday with Congressman Sarbanes. Stan, are you there? Well, Congressman Stan wanted to talk about dark money. So you talk about transparency, yep. Disclosure. How would it change the current regulation given the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court a few years ago?
So as you know, the Citizens United case, which was really a tragic ruling on the part of the Supreme Court because it opened the floodgates in terms of this dark money, secret money coming from billionaires and millionaires using super PACs to flood the zone of our politics. There are ways to push back on that. Obviously, the ideal would be a constitutional amendment where we could actually regulate this outside money. That's going to be tough to achieve, although H.R. 1 is going to speak to that as an important priority. But in the meantime, we can demand much more transparency and disclosure so we at least know where that money is coming from. We can re-empower agencies like the IRS and the SEC to look harder and disclose what's happening with some of these entities that are pouring money secretly into our elections. And we can generally make sure that people are having to raise their hand if they're spending money in our elections and identify themselves. That's a kind of baseline expectation that the public has. At the same time, we want to find a way for everyday Americans to actually compete with the big money for the attention of candidates. That's about getting onto the field of your own democracy as a power player, not just putting a ref on the field to blow the whistle on the big money crowd, but actually stepping onto the field yourself. And that's where building a new system of funding campaigns where small donors are the leverage point in the system and they get the respect and the attention of candidates is so important. You're seeing it happen across the country. Baltimore City, in this last election, passed a ballot initiative on fair elections. We've seen it in Montgomery County. In Howard County, they have a new system going into place. And all around the country, citizen-owned elections are becoming the new expectation of the public. We can do that in Washington as well. That helps people compete against the big money.
When it comes to the options, the opportunities that a democratically controlled Congress will have in terms of ethical violations by the Trump administration within the legislature or the executive branch, cabinet members, members of the White House staff, etc. What kind of coordination is going on between the House Oversight Committee, which Congressman Cummings chairs and you serve on, or, you know, Maxine Waters in the Banking Committee, or Adam Schiff in the Intelligence Committee, or Gerald Nadler in the Judiciary Committee? I mean, obviously, there needs to be some sort of coordinated effort to figure out how and when to subpoena documents, what sorts of hearings need to be held. Take us behind the scenes. What's going on?
Well, you're right. And there's a lot of oversight to be done. And I think one of the other messages that the public sent in this last midterm was they want to restore some checks and balances. That's why when people refer to it as a blue wave, I agree to some degree, but I also was calling it a red, white, and blue wave because I think the most patriotic thing that Americans want to see is checks and balances working under their Constitution. And they didn't perceive that that was the case before because the Republican leadership in Congress was completely acquiescing to the executive branch and was not doing the kind of oversight that they have a responsibility to do as the Article I legislature under our Constitution.
But is there a danger that the Democrats can overreach? There's oversight and overreach. I mean, if there is this fog of subpoenas, of this fog of hearings, this you know, multiplicity of accusations and propping up ethical issues, you know, that have been simmering for months now. I mean, it's going to be difficult for people to keep track.
That can be a danger, but I'm very confident that the chairs of the committees that you referred to are going to approach this with a very steady hand. Elijah Cummings is a perfect example. As chair of the Oversight and Government Reform Committee, he's going to conduct oversight in a measured, steady way. He's going to get to the bottom of serious questions that are out there, but he has said he's not going to be handing subpoenas out like candy. He's going to be very thoughtful about the kinds of investigations that need to be done. And you're right. There's a danger of chasing every shiny object that comes along. I think the priority will be on issues that are presenting a clear and present danger to the democracy or to certain issues that people care deeply about. So, for example, anything having to do with voting irregularities, that warrants oversight because we're headed right into the next election. 2020 could see historic turnouts across the spectrum. I anticipate that. Well, is our election system, is the fabric of it, the infrastructure of it, the integrity of it, going to be in a position to handle that kind of historic turnout and give the voters confidence in the results? We need to be doing the kind of oversight that assures that. The census is coming. We need to make sure the census is going to be conducted in a fair and impartial way that gathers all the data, because the census is about power. So we need to look at the things that are immediate priorities. And I think that's a way to kind of triage this, you know, huge demand for oversight that's coming at us. I think we can do that in a very responsible fashion.
I have another question on the phone from George in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday. George, I guess your question is about something we have talked a little bit about so far, about redistricting. What's your quick question for the congressman?
Thank you very much for taking my call, Tom, and thank you for doing an excellent job on this. And thank both to you, Tom, and to your leadership, Congressman Sarbanes. There is nothing more important that you could be doing. Now, my question is, in H.R. 1, hello?
Yes.
Yes, you're on the air, George.
Mm-hmm. In H.R. 1, can you build in a system whereby Democratic legislatures could take leadership and produce a formula, a reciprocal formula, whereby if specific states meet specific requirements for establishing redistricting, a bipartisan redistricting, that there would be, as soon as a Republican state reaches the same criterion, that you would automatically start, you know, you would encourage, take leadership, do what you're doing, but really show that if you, you know, give the Republicans an offer or a system that they cannot refuse, to promote the idea of nonpartisan redistricting, which
okay.
is so important
for
our democracy.
Thanks for that question, George. I mean, when it comes to gerrymandering and redistricting, Republicans and Democrats alike, you know, Maryland is an example of Democratic gerrymandering, mm-hmm. and there's plenty of Republican examples as well. Is H.R. 1 going to make it possible for 50 states then to establish commissions to control districts?
Well, that's the idea behind it, is you create a national standard of what will result in fair maps, whether that's ordering that everybody do an independent redistricting commission, or by whatever process they choose that they meet certain standards. You know, there's these formulas and models that have been developed over the last few years, Tom, as you know, that can judge whether a system is producing political, hyper-political gerrymandering or not. So you could insist that a certain set of standards be met by every state when they're doing federal redistricting that assures that those maps are being drawn in a fair way. Now, I think what the caller was also getting to was the idea that if we create those new standards and that new fairness with respect to how federal congressional districts are drawn, you then encourage, you put peer pressure on state legislatures and states to put the same kinds of standards in place with respect to how state-level legislative districts are drawn as well. So you get into this kind of virtuous cycle where everybody's trying to get to a new standard of accountability. And I think we can do that not just with respect to redistricting, but with respect to voting rights, with respect to ethics. There were a lot of state-level ballot initiatives that were successful in the 2018 midterms that generally support this idea of cleaning up the system and fighting corruption. So we can begin to borrow from what we do at the federal level, the state level, and together get to a new place where the people feel like their voice is the one that's respected.
A cycle of virtue. Wouldn't that be a nice thing?
Yes.
All right, we'll talk a little bit more about that, and I will try to get to a few calls when we come back from a break. So callers, stay on the line. We will do our best to get to you. By the way, you are listening to Midday, let me remind you, with Congressman John Sarbanes. And before we take a break on Mondays here on Midday, it is our practice to read the names of the people who lost their lives to violence in the previous week. We stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. As the year comes to a close, so far in 2018, 298 people have lost their lives to violence in Baltimore City. Last week, police identified six victims of homicide in Baltimore. They are Antonio Wright, age 26, Daniel Battle, age 42, Terrell Singleton, age 46, James McFadden, age 47, Ebony Moore, age 25, and Michael Handy. He was 17 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Before we continue our conversation with Congressman John Sarbanes, news about a couple of appointments that we learned about Friday afternoon. The Baltimore Orioles have made it official. They've chosen Brandon Hyde as their next manager. He's the most recently been the bench coach for the Chicago Cubs. He becomes the Orioles' 20th manager. And an appointment that got a little less attention, Governor Larry Hogan has announced that Grace Cavalieri will be Maryland's new poet laureate. She is the 10th poet to hold that position. She's published 24 books of poetry. She's also a playwright, and she's been the host of a radio show in Washington called The Poet and the Poem for more than 20 years. She's also written texts and lyrics for opera and television, and she has established two publishing houses that focus on publishing poetry. So we have a new poet laureate here in Merritt, Grace Cavalieri. If you've just joined us, my guest today is Congressman John Sarbanes. He represents the 3rd Congressional District here in Maryland. Last month, he was reelected for a 7th term. He serves on the House Energy and Commerce Committee as well as the House Oversight Committee, and he chairs the House Democracy Reform Task Force. He is the primary author of a bill that addresses ethics and campaign finance reform, a bill that incoming Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi has designated H.R. 1. It will be the first order of business when the new Congress begins its work next month. If you have a question or comment, we'll try to get to it. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. We are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page, and you can send us a tweet. Let's go to Farouk in Baltimore. Farouk, you want to talk about the possibility of a government shutdown. What's on your mind?
Right. Good afternoon, sir. Good afternoon, Mr. Sarbanes. Thank you very much for your hard work. If the government shut down, and I saw the president say, I'd love to shut down, what about his salary? His salary will be comes under that furlough, or he will not get paid? Whole White House will not get paid if the government shut down, and all his benefit will be on furlough or suspended for a week or two?
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Farouk. So a government shutdown would be a partial shutdown because some of the appropriations for some of the agencies have already been approved, but some have not. There's an estimate that maybe 300,000 people in the federal workforce live here in Maryland. What's your guess as to what's going to happen Friday?
Well, it's hard to know because the president has really dug in on this wall, the $5 billion that he wants for the wall. It has to be said that I think Republicans and Democrats were in a place where we could agree on an end-of-year deal, and that would include a certain amount of funding for border security, including some fencing at certain places along the way. So left to our own devices, the Democrats and Republicans in Congress could have had a deal by now, and we wouldn't be facing this shutdown. But obviously, you need the president's signature in order to get the budget in place. And the president has taken this very, very hard line. Now, the fact is that I don't think he has the votes. He certainly doesn't have them in the Senate. I don't even think he has them in the House right now for that $5 billion that he wants for the wall. So the ball's in his court. He has to decide if it's worth it to shut the government down, to go get a priority that he can't even get votes for in his own party in the House of Representatives. I mean, this is, to me, it's a failure of leadership. And it's ironic because the Republicans were trying to demonstrate over the course of the last year that they knew how to do budgeting, that they were going to get things done, that there wasn't going to be a lot of disruption at the end of the process. And out of left field, here comes their own president, you know, upsetting the apple cart. Hopefully, the president will take a more reasonable posture in the next few days. We can get a budget passed that completes the process by Friday at midnight, which is the next deadline that's looming, and we won't have to go through this partial shutdown, but it's very much his call at this point.
And voters are justifiably confused and somewhat flummoxed about claims made about this border wall. Chuck Schumer, Senate Minority Leader, says that the $1.5 billion that was appropriated the last time, only 6% of that money has actually been spent by the administration. Yet there was an official from the administration testifying before Congress saying that that's not the case. How are people supposed to know what's true and what's not when it comes to those kinds of claims? Because it's not just the border wall. It's a million other issues that, you know, it's he said, she said all the time between Republicans and Democrats.
Well, of course, now, Tom, you're describing the state of our world almost when it comes to how people get information and whether they can digest it and the sources that it comes from. I mean, there are ways to verify some of these things. The president, I think, plays fairly fast and loose with the facts a lot of the time. There are agencies, there are organizations that actually provide, I think, a very good accounting and reckoning of what the facts are. So you have to dig down. The press plays an important role. And I think the press is really kind of stepping up now to call out lack of transparency and bad information when they see it. And they've certainly called out this administration and this president repeatedly. So this is another example where sort of drilling down and getting the press to determine, well, what is the real story, I think, is going to be important. But unfortunately, the president seems more interested in turning this end-of-year budget situation into another episode of a reality TV show instead of participating in constructive conversation about how to reach a compromise, an agreement.
And of course,
hopefully he'll change that posture in the next few days.
And of course, the promise was that Mexico was going to pay for the wall. Anyway, let's go to another call. Doug in Reservoir Hill, you want to talk about an issue that we haven't brought up and I didn't even think about bringing up. What's on your mind?
Well, thank you all for your service to our community. The problem is the congressman keeps on talking about oversight committees. My first question is, who is the oversight committee for these do not call lists?
All right, let's talk about that to the congressman. Not call lists, because they often don't work. We still get an awful lot of calls, both on our landlines and cell phones.
So the committee of jurisdiction, I think, is probably energy and commerce because of the telecommunications jurisdiction that we have. And I know that there's been hearings on this. I also know how incredibly frustrating it is for people because they get their name put on a do not call list, and then they continue to get calls from certain kinds of vendors. The reality is that the people who operate in this shadowy space of making these phone calls over and over again, and oftentimes doing it in a way that preys on people that are vulnerable, for example, it is incredibly hard to catch these people. They can shut down an operation on a Tuesday and start another operation on a Wednesday in another state or from outside of our borders. So it's a cat and mouse game all the time. The money they're making from it is easily enough for them to justify the risk when they're violating the law. So you have people that are breaking the law under the do not call rules, but catching them and keeping them shut down is a very difficult prospect for law enforcement. It doesn't mean we don't continue to try and put those rules in place, but I get it. I know why people are frustrated about that.
Aaron from Highland Town sends us an email asking about the student loan interest rate. Can we get it to near or below zero? He says this would effectively act as an economic stimulus by simply allowing people to direct money away from interest to other areas of their lives and serve as an incentive for people to continue their education.
Yeah, I think you're going to see a lot of attention under the Democratic chairman of the Education and Labor Committee, Bobby Scott, the incoming chair, on all these issues that affect student borrowers, whether it's looking at the interest rate and things we can do to make that more reasonable for student borrowers, whether it's looking at this public service loan forgiveness program, where you see these private lenders who are the kind of middlemen in the process have been looking out not for the student borrowers, but they're looking out for sort of these bottom line for-profit lenders out there instead. By the way, Betsy DeVos has been helping that industry and not helping student borrowers. So I know that Congressman Scott, in his position as chair of education and labor, is planning to hold hearings to look at all these issues that affect student borrowers, because it's a huge burden that they carry. And we should be doing everything we can to relieve that burden in a reasonable way. So stay tuned, because I think that's going to be a real focus in the next Congress.
Let's go back to the phones to Graham in Baltimore County. Welcome to Midday with Congressman John Sarbanes.
Hey there. Thanks so much for fielding my question. My question is, with all the focus on electoral reform, whether any attention is going to be paid to the millions of Americans who don't have voting rights because they live in a disenfranchised territory like the District of Columbia or Puerto Rico.
Thank you. And we've been working with the delegates from the various territories, with Eleanor Holmes Norton from the District of Columbia, to make sure that within H.R. 1 there are provisions that address those grievances, whether that'll be in the form of language which affirms our commitment to address them over time, whether there's actual statutory provisions that we're able to include remains to be seen. But we understand that that is a very important priority, as you say, of millions of people out there who feel that they aren't properly enfranchised under the current rules, and we definitely want to speak to that. So I appreciate that question.
Let me ask you a question, Congressman, about the future of the ACA, the Affordable Care Act. There was a ruling on Friday in a court in Texas basically overruling or saying that the law is unconstitutional. Following that decision on Friday, the federal government has now filed a motion to dismiss the case here in Maryland that Attorney General Brian Frosch brought against the federal government for its efforts to dismantle the ACA. He did that. He brought that suit in September. They're meeting Wednesday morning at 10 o'clock to decide whether or not that suit can be dismissed. What is the future of the ACA? Is it the Democratic position to just sort of wait and hope that will be over, that the judge's decision in Texas will be overruled on appeal, or are there going to be movements to legislate reenacting or reinstating certain provisions of the ACA?
I think you'll definitely see a movement to legislate strengthening the ACA, even in the face of this latest attack. I think is one of the first things we do in the next Congress. Democrats are going to try to weigh in more formally with the litigation process, you know, on behalf of the House of Representatives to indicate where we stand with respect to how these cases are proceeding. So we need to fight back against what has been a very well-coordinated plan to undermine the ACA, protect it for the Americans that have benefited, millions of people have benefited across this country, and that's what we intend to do.
Congressman John Sarbanes, he represents the 3rd Congressional District. He'll be part of the 116th Congress when they reconvene on the 3rd of January. Good to see you, sir. Happy holidays.
Thanks, Tom. You too.
That's it for us today. Tomorrow it's Midday with the Mayor. Mayor Catherine Pugh joins me here in Studio A with the latest on Joel Fitzgerald. He's her nominee to lead the Baltimore Police Department. We'll also talk about many other issues affecting our city. That's tomorrow on Midday. We want to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends. You can find them on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. healthypeoplejuice.com. We also want to thank Healthy People Juice for providing us with fresh local artisan cold-pressed vegetables and fruit juices. Healthy People Juice is a social enterprise centered around community service and health. They offer a variety of cold-pressed organic juices. They're in Fells Point, and you can find out more on the web at healthypeoplejuice.com. I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate your listening. Stay tuned for the latest headlines and Here and Now. That's coming up at the top of the hour. Have a great day.